Welcome everybody, thanks for coming along. It's very interesting to see the previous session was very developer focused and at the end of it everyone streamed out and a whole new audience has come in, so it's great to see you all. My name's Ian Morris from Information Leadership. I used to be at Microsoft for 10 years, so don't hold that against me. And this session really is just my thoughts and feelings about SharePoint. It's not endorsed by Microsoft and Wayne's down the back of the room to shoot me if I say anything too controversial. I've been running this little website up there that has kind of a montage of all the public websites, all the ones I could find that run SharePoint. So it's really nice. It's still running in Silverlight, unfortunately. But if you want to go and see people around the world that host their SharePoint internet site online, that's a great little app to go and have a look at. It's a good 3,000-odd websites that I've discovered that run on SharePoint. But most of my work has got nothing to do with internet-facing sites. So I've had 33 years in ICT, always something new to learn every day, though. 10 years at Microsoft, still a Microsoft Virtual TSP. Now I've had 3 years at Information Leadership, which is a Microsoft Gold Certified Partner. We do lots of SharePoint implementations, lots of Public Record Act grade, EDRMS and intranets, and now Office 365. And we've got deployments throughout the country. And I reckon arguably the biggest SharePoint team in New Zealand because none of those people are developers. So our agenda today, and I'm going to go fast because about 100 slides to get through in 45 minutes. So hosting options, we've got on-premise is going to be the big focus of this talk. Thinking about the requirements for on-premise deployment. What were the changes in 2010? And topology is really the big thing we're looking at. What kind of topology do you need for SharePoint? And then any questions and answers afterwards. So SharePoint, I don't know why you're all here for an on-premise deployment because we're all moving to the cloud, right? Yep, everyone going to the cloud. It's really good. The thing is, I guess some of us are going to take some time to get there. So there's still going to be quite a period of time where we're going to be using on-premise. But 365, hands down, the lowest cost. The lowest cost way of getting SharePoint is to use 365. You've got to focus on a couple of things if you want to use it. And the key thing for me is getting your identity solution for any kind of cloud integration working. That's kind of the first thing IT should be doing, working on that identity solution, doing your directory integration. There's been some great sessions here at TechEd on that, quite a few different ways of doing it, but focusing on single sign-on, really, really key. One of the big things about using online, though, is you've got to worry about this thing called site quota management. You only get a fixed amount of storage space in 365, and so you've really got to allocate which site collections get what out of my total pool of storage. Microsoft made a good change recently. We always used to focus on having a site collection that didn't get too big. If online, they've realized it was too hard to manage a couple of hundred site collections, so they said, go for it. Have huge, huge site collection now. So a lot of New Zealand customers could probably build their entire SharePoint deployment in one site collection. It's a bit scary from a permissions point of view, but you can do it. And latency is the other thing to consider. It's really good if you're using Office. So if you've got Office 2013, there's really no problems. It works really, really fast. But as soon as you load up any other application that uses WebDAV to talk to SharePoint online, that's when you start really noticing some problems like Microsoft Project or Visio or any of the Adobe products or AutoCAD. All of a sudden that user's behavior of hitting save every 5 minutes, they are then frozen until it's finished transferring the entire file up to 365. Whereas Office 2013, it's got like a byte range transfer. If you edit one page and then you hit save, it only sends the differences back up over the wire. So Microsoft did a fantastic job with that. Obviously, you're looking at potentially just doing that Active Directory integration. And then the next option really is doing a hybrid where we've got some SharePoint online, and one of the great things here I think is using OneDrive for Business. So giving every user a terabyte of storage in the cloud, you wouldn't do that on-premise. Good luck managing that. What happens when your employee leaves your organization and they've stored a terabyte of documents in the cloud? What's going to happen? Their manager's going to inherit all of that and have to deal with it. So great, I wouldn't want to be a manager. The other good thing about this hybrid model, you want to use SharePoint online. SharePoint on-premise, but you also want to deploy Access applications. They are really cool, but a whole lot of extra infrastructure for your online deployment, for your on-premise deployment. That's a great reason for using hybrid and use Access apps in the cloud. There is still a bit of limited integration with this hybrid model. So yes, you can do some search integration, you can do some BCS integration, but you've still kind of got two different islands of information to be aware of. Then there's the private cloud, and this is starting to really take off in New Zealand now. You've got infrastructure as a service, all the government options there. You get some great benefits around licensing. You either use the traditional SPLA model where you pay the monthly fee to the hoster for your cows, or you can, if you've got the right license, you can transfer your licensing over to the SPLA and say, please host our servers for us using your existing enterprise agreement. Obviously, things like storage costs, though, you're going to start paying for SharePoint in a private cloud, all the storage that you need. Traditionally, on-premise, it just all goes into that big sand bucket you've got, and no individual application has to pay for its storage. With hosting in the private cloud, you're going to be paying for all of that. And these virtual machines are very big, so they're likely to cost you a fair bit of money as well. It's not like just a single server VM that you're paying for. There's large virtual machines involved, and they have a real cost associated with them. And you can do some much more clever things around network redundancy, depending on who your ISP is, to make sure you can always get from your office to the hoster who's hosting your infrastructure. So it's kind of really good. You normally just look at a VPN tunnel into that hoster, and you plonk everything there in that infrastructure as a service provider. And they worry about air conditioning, power, capacity of the data center. You don't have to invest in that side of things. Another good thing about this model is you can have different people managing it. So you can have someone managing your Windows servers, you can have someone else coming in managing SharePoint on top of that as an application, quite flexible. And then we've got Microsoft Azure, which can host SharePoint for us now too. So we've got that option, and there's a brand new provisioning template. This thing's pretty cool, so you can just go straight to Microsoft Azure, and you can say, yep, I want to host a SharePoint farm. So you pick your SharePoint farm, and you can go through and configure it all up. And then you get across all the virtual machines you need. And then you start looking at the prices. So we've got to pick from the standard Azure VM models, which don't quite align with what we want with SharePoint. So I really want 4-core and maybe 16 gigs of RAM. I either get 4-core and 7 gigs or 8-core and 14 gigs, at $655 a month, and I'm going to need quite a few of those, so it starts adding up. But very nice now to provision the whole farm, click the button, go. Just remember that your credit card's going to be taking a hammering there. And I worked out some of the costs. This is a little bit out of date now, but this is only for one of each of those servers. We're up for $15,000 a year on a 12-month contract, and to do HA, I'd need at least double that, so $30,000 a year. I'd buy a bit of tin for that. So it's definitely an option and very nice and fast to deploy, especially if you want testing, a non-production environment. Great way to deploy that in Azure, nice and fast. So really, and I've given you a quick show of the VM templates that are available, but on-premise is what we're really here for today. And so your first decision really is around, the features that you want, what are your functional requirements. But then we get down to it's virtualization and storage capacity. So how many people here are using VMware for all of their server hosting? Yep. Everyone else is using Hyper-V. If you're using Hyper-V, yeah, Hyper-V is way, way better. But anyway, you've got a big investment in VMware, so go for it. But it's the size of those virtual machines that are really the issue. Overcommit, things like that are not nice in a VMware environment. So, processor affinity. We're talking about having however many virtual cores we need for SharePoint. They should be 100% allocated to our VMware cores. Kind of the downside of doing on-premise is your staff capacity or capability to manage a SharePoint environment. It's definitely getting more complex with 2013. It's not simple. It gives you the flexibility, though, to deploy custom applications and third-party features on top of that platform, which might be required for your business requirements. Doing the Public Record Act, you might need some kind of third-party document management system on there. Integration with some of your other line of business applications, much easier when you're on-premise. So what changed in 2013? How many people here have come from 2010 or still running 2010? We've got quite a lot of people. So there were a lot of changes. Huge amount of changes, in fact. So this is I could spend probably 2 days going through all of these changes. Really, the only thing that hasn't changed, and really hasn't changed since 2003, is basic document management in SharePoint. So checking in and out a document, the versioning on a document, has not changed in a long time. It's all the extra things that have gone into the platform. And what Microsoft look at with each version of SharePoint, one of the very first criteria, what are we going to do with the next version? They say, what were the deployment blockers in the current version? Why would people not deploy SharePoint 2010? And most of those issues were around very large organisations. You know, if you had 100,000 employees, it was a bit of a challenge deploying a SharePoint farm to meet that workload. So a lot of infrastructure went into 2013 to deal with those very large environments, which added a lot of overhead to the what we call the SharePoint farm. And so that's kind of a tax or a burden on us in New Zealand now that we have to have all this extra plumbing and infrastructure inside the SharePoint 2013 farm that we really didn't need. Some of it still has some benefits, but it's an overhead, which makes, you know, trying to start up our SharePoint farm need a lot more resources than it did in 2010. A couple of things completely changed. Like under apps, everyone talks about apps. There is the new apps model, but Office web applications were a whole new thing in 2013. Can't be installed on the SharePoint farm. They're more servers, but they're very cool. You should not consider deploying SharePoint 2013 without Office web apps. Microsoft made them free for read-only mode. If you have Office 2013 licenses internally, then you can deploy it in the read-write mode. But if you don't have Office 2013, maybe you're sticking with Office 2010, you can still deploy Office web apps 2013 in read-only mode, and that'll light up in your search results inside your document libraries, so people can quickly preview documents without having to open them. Fantastic feature. The other big one that I'm going to focus on a lot is search. It's got quite a big overhead. Demo's fantastic, and half of that demo is the Office web apps, but finding things so much better in SharePoint 2013 than it was in 2010, but that comes with a big overhead that we'll talk about. The other one around scalability that Microsoft put in was this thing called the distributed cache, and that's something that really is kind of part of SharePoint, but it's not. It's delivered by some other components, so managing that, dealing with that, understanding how that affects our farm topology is another thing we're going to cover. So Microsoft improved, as I said, scalability. A whole lot of things increased. So, you know, we can go, you know, from 250,000 site collections to 750,000. Awesome number. We have quite a few customers that have 5,000 to 10,000 site collections. That's very doable. You know, increasing the number of content databases in our farm, increasing, you know, the number of site collections actually in a single content database. Great for my sites if you've got 100,000 employees, you're only going to need 10 content databases if you're going to limit the size of their site collections. But the big thing about all of these boundaries, and remember that some of the boundaries are hard boundaries, like the moment you go over it, you break it, and other ones are tested. So the performance is acceptable up to this boundary. After that, it's not supported because it hasn't been tested. So there's quite a distinction there. But the key thing I point out to most people, all of those boundaries assume that you're using SQL Server Enterprise. So how many people here use SQL Server Standard for their SharePoint farm? SQL Server Standard. Everyone else using Enterprise? Put your hand up if you're using Enterprise, so you can actually see. So this is quite a change. A lot more people have started investing in SQL Enterprise for their SharePoint farm, which is good to see. But if you are using SQL Standard, you can still do it for SharePoint, and a lot of customers are in that mode with still, you know, a SQL Server per application. So SharePoint gets its own SQL Server, and other apps, you know, CRM and Dynamics get their own SQL Servers. You can certainly consolidate now and just run multiple instances. You really want to use SQL Enterprise for that, and we'll talk a little bit about some of the constraints around SQL Standard, because in the smaller customers, the kind of, you know, 200 to 1,000 users, they will often be using a SQL Server Standard for SharePoint. So the good thing about 2013, it was designed much better for scalability, and our options are really scale up and scale out, you know, for the different roles within SharePoint. And Microsoft kind of changed the what we used to call the application server now to the batch processing layer. And the key application are these specialized workloads, and search is the one that really fits into that. So we've got the option of independently for these different layers, scaling out or scaling up. So the couple of issues there with scale out for New Zealand really is your server licensing. Yes, I could add another web front-end server or a dedicated search server, but that's another SharePoint server license. On average, probably about 10K a server. So, you know, I add another two servers, there's another 20K out of my budget. Also, the more servers you get, the more network overhead there is, and you really need to start looking at, once you've got probably more than four servers in your SharePoint farm, you know, dual homing those servers and separating out the network traffic for end users versus the network traffic from those SharePoint servers between themselves and back to the SQL Server box. So the other issue then with scale up is really around virtualization, and we start to actually see this a lot now. You need a minimum of four cores for a SharePoint server. Now, I've got some customers that say we never give a machine more than one core, and it's an exception to give it two cores. SharePoint 2013 is not supported with less than four cores because there's so many threads going on, threads having to be executed, you run out of thread pool count. So four cores is the minimum, and a single server is actually six cores minimum to be supported by Microsoft. So really the big issue is with virtualization is overcommitting your physical cores. If you count up all the logical cores across all your virtual machines versus your physical cores, if you've got, say, a 2-to-1 or a 3-to-1 ratio, that's great if all your virtual machines are one core, because VMware can, or Hyper-V can madly swap them around, not a problem. As soon as you go above two cores, there's a lot more work for that virtualization platform to go, SharePoint's not currently running, I've got to free up four cores somewhere to get SharePoint, that host, back in. How am I going to do that? How long is that going to take? And then we run into things like NUMA boundaries. So if you don't know about this and you do run a VMware overcommitted environment, you need to go away and understand NUMA boundaries and then decide, are there certain SharePoint servers, especially like the search server maybe that's doing crawling, that I should allocate 100% physical cores to those logical cores on that virtual machine. And that can make the difference in, say, indexing of it being able to do it twice as fast than otherwise if you had an overcommitted environment without allocating those CPUs. So that's the biggest issue we have now. Just about every customer now when we're deploying SharePoint is saying, yeah, we're just waiting for another VMware host to come, you know, because everyone's maxed out their VMware environments. So the distributed cache I mentioned was a great performance feature that's been added in 2013. There's a couple of key things, though, is that it should not be run on your indexing server. A lot of people don't realize this. A lot of people use AutoSP Installer, great PowerShell utility for installing a SharePoint farm. Most partners use it, which is good. So as a customer, if you get one partner to build it, then another partner comes along to support it, we all just say, yeah, we use the AutoSP Installer to build the farm. But by default, that's going to put this distributed cache on every server in the farm. So there's a health check rule that actually says if you've got four servers or more, distributed cache shouldn't be running on four servers. It's a health check that comes up, but it also shouldn't be running on your, normally we call it your index server, but it's actually your content processing server that the distributed cache should not run on. By default, it kind of is auto-tuning. It sets itself up. It goes and grabs 5% of the available memory of the server as soon as it starts up, less 2 gigs of RAM. But then behind the scenes, it's got quite an overhead to run, so it will use twice the amount of memory. So I always set most of our SharePoint farms up with a fixed distributed cache size, and it's usually about the 1 gig for 1,000 users. It gives us a huge amount of performance in certain areas, which is really good. But I don't just leave it to chance and let the distributed cache itself decide how to do it, so manually set it. As I said, health warning. And if you are running like a four-server farm or bigger, so you've got your web front-end servers, the biggest benefit of the distributed cache is on the web front-end. So that's the only place you should really be running it, and remove it from your application servers. And funny enough, the distributed cache, it's an Azure service, which has got distributed capability in it, but in SharePoint it's not distributed. Okay, so a server running the cache has a copy of some data cached in it, but it doesn't distribute that to your other server automatically. So a couple of the key things that it is used for, there's a couple of things here. The very top one is about your login token. So because SharePoint now runs by default in claims mode, you get a token back that's cached in the distributed cache. So you don't need things like NLB affinity anymore. You don't need sticky sessions because if you go to the other web front end, it'll get it out of the cache, even though that might be on the other web front end. So that's good. The other big one that I find is the search performance. If the distributed cache is behaving itself, your search web parts run really, really fast, which is quite important if you're using the query by search web part. You get about a 50% cache hit ratio out of the distributed cache for rendering that. So you imagine on your intranet, you put a search web part that's showing the latest discussions across your discussion boards. Now, that doesn't change, you know, really that much minute by minute. So every time people are hitting your homepage, you know, what's in that search result or the query that web part is using is already being cached and coming back really fast. There's some web parts that use view state. You know, in the old days of ASP.NET, if there were any developers, your view state got really, really big. And if you didn't want to have sticky sessions, you had to write that to a SQL database, which meant, you know, another hit for every time we loaded a page that had ASP.NET web parts on it that wanted to remember the expand, collapse status and filter status. So that's now all stored in the distributed cache as well. So really good performance if that's set up and working. If you don't have a healthy distributed cache, you'll often see things like pages taking 20 or 30 seconds to load. So the other big area for the distributed cache was the social content aspect of SharePoint 2013. Now, I love SharePoint 2013 social features. I reckon they're spectacular. You've got SharePoint 2013 social, and you've got Yammer. And Yammer is great, but it's only in the cloud. So if you're here because you're one of those customers that, for whatever reason, can't use the cloud, can't have all of your users accessing the internet to have social discussions, then the SharePoint Social is still a really, really good solution. Obviously, it's just going to have no future development from Microsoft. In fact, they're doing everything they can to hide it and force you into Yammer. And Yammer's good. If you like, the key difference for me is SharePoint Social has subject and body. It's a bit like email. Being a veteran of IT, I can't give up my email, whereas Yammer doesn't have a subject. You can have hashtags, but I do use Yammer a lot, and I don't see many hashtags in Yammer. And they're not the same hashtags that SharePoint has, so it's an island of information. It's great for communicating or pushing stuff out, but we also have Link, and I use Link a lot. So it's a bit confusing as to which one you should use, but the key thing here is in managing the distributed cache in your environment. If you shut down your servers and then start them back up, all of this feed information, which you may have been displaying on pages, gets lost because it was only stored in the distributed cache. Now, there is a time, a job that will go through and rebuild the data that's in that cache. There are some places that can go back and extract that data to populate the cache from the different generators. Some stuff can't be reconstituted. So the key thing is, because the cache isn't actually distributed, we might have it installed on both our web front-end servers, but we can't just shut down the web front-end server. We've got to shut down the distributed cache, which will trigger copying any stuff unique in that cache over to the other web front-end server's distributed cache before we then take that SharePoint server offline. So pretty important thing to remember. Otherwise, you start your SharePoint farm back up and a whole bunch of your web pages have got no content in them, which is something to be aware of. Search, as I said, was the other big area. Most people would have seen this diagram, the search topology. But what I really look at is what's the impact of each of these components on the SharePoint farm, which will determine what kind of topology I need. So the crawl component, everyone's always familiar with crawl. We had this in 2010. Okay. In 2013, it doesn't do very much now. All the crawl does is go and find all the URLs, stuff them in a SQL table for the content processing component to then go and get all of those URLs and actually go and get the content. So crawling's really, really fast, really, really quick. Doesn't do a lot, and it's actually still really the SharePoint 2010 crawler that's just going out and finding all those URLs that need to then be indexed. It doesn't do much. Ignore a couple of comments there. I've got some of my slides out the wrong way. Content processing is really where it's all at, and this really is the core fast component that came in that really processes all of those URLs that are in that link table. This is the thing that hammers your server. This is one of those processes that just makes your server run at 100% CPU for, depending on how much content you've got, maybe 12 hours. Now, some people don't like seeing a server running for 12 hours at 100% CPU. They go, we can't have that. We don't want any server running more than 60% utilization. Well, that's like buying a V8 and pulling three of the spark plugs out, you know. I want my indexing, my content processing, to do it as fast as it can. Yes, I can make the server run at 60% utilization, but then it's going to take 20 hours to index your content, not 12. So be aware, this role is going to nail your server. This is one of these NodeRunner.exe things you see people talking about. But the interesting thing about the NodeRunner for content processing, it runs at a high priority level in Windows. So you know your Windows services, most of them run normal. This one runs at high, and that means all the other things aren't going to get much of a look in. So if that application server is also running other things, they're not going to run too well. They're not going to respond, especially if the user queries are dependent on one of those other services, like Excel services, something like that you might have running on the same server. Because this thing's running high, once you do a full crawl, it's absolutely going to be nailed. Even incremental or continuous crawling will also have an impact on the responsiveness of that server. Now, I've got a good tip for how to deal with that later on. Analytics processing component, this is one that you can farm off to another server. The key thing here is what this does is modifies the ranking a lot in the SharePoint search results. It also gives you a standard query option for recent content, you know, what's been changed, popular content. So what's clicked on the most? It's not self-fulfilling, but it is based on the content, say, in libraries, what documents are people most frequently reviewing or reusing, what's kind of reusable content. versus content that's just created and then archived there. So that analytics processing helps us identify popular content and the popularity ranking that you get in the search results. Then there's the index component. And Microsoft made a big change, and it's quite funny. We're going back. So 2003, 2007 relied on the file system for the full text catalog. 2010 changed that and put it all back into the SQL database. And that was fine for organizations kind of New Zealand size, but didn't work for the really big organizations because that SQL database was getting hammered because the index was trying to write all the index data into it. The users trying to execute queries were trying to suck the data out of it. There was a huge amount of contention in that database, especially if you only had SQL Server Standard. So Microsoft in 2013 have moved a lot of that stuff back to the file system. But it also means now there's a bigger dependency on that, and you should have a whole separate drive on your server running this role, the index component, which will normally be also your content processing server. You need a whole separate drive, and it's really quite hard to calculate how big that drive should be, and I've learned from experience. One, you don't want to let that drive run out of space, but give you an idea, 1.6 million items needs more than 100 gigs of space. I've seen two numbers on the Microsoft website. One says 300 gigs, another says 500 gigs, but no actual calculation for how big that should be. But it needs to be a different volume, and it needs to, that volume needs to be on any service that you want to distribute the index component across. If you want to have high availability on end-user searching, then you need that the index component or a replica of it on more than one server. Those servers have to have this extra volume on them to store the catalog. And if you do put this on the web front end, which is where the query is, when you're doing a full index and that's busy updating all these files, all of a sudden your queries get really slow for users. Some people may have noticed this. Sometimes search is really fast, and all of a sudden it's really, really slow. And that's because an incremental crawl or something's happening in the back end that's tying that up. So executing user queries, you know, that's what the user does. They type something in the search box, the query processing component takes that, it does a whole bunch of things on working out what relevancy should we be using, linguistics, you know, sounds like, all that kind of stuff's been done by that, and then it's going to the index partition to actually get the data back. And that's the one that you definitely can run and want to run on your web front end server. There is a search admin component. Again, remember to run this on more than one server because there's a whole bunch of things that don't work if there isn't a search admin component running. The search admin component also makes sure all the other search components are running. So if you ever go into Windows Services and stop OSearch 15, you'll find it starts up again because the search admin component is responsible for keeping it running, which it does. Now, one of the key things about that content processing I mentioned, it runs at a high level in Windows as a Windows service. And by default, it runs 3 threads per core. So if you've got a 4-core machine, you know, it's going to run 16 threads at high priority, grabbing those documents in from wherever they are, from SharePoint, from the file system, pulling in web pages from websites, and then crunching those and doing all the you know, full text indexing on them, relevancy. Really, really high workload. If you're trying to use that content processing server for other roles as well, I recommend personally that you decrease the number of threads that are going to be used. Now, you can't go less than one, so it's still going to do 1 thread per core, but at least you're going to get a bit of breathing room on that server. Instead of it running at absolutely 100% for a full crawl, it's going to get the odd little, you know, where other things can get stuff done. And those other things in SharePoint really are timer jobs. And if you ever looked at your timer jobs, there are hundreds of them, okay, and they're all running at different times, trying to get things done. If they happen to be running on that server and it's doing a full crawl, a lot of those things either time out or have some issues with them. So think, especially if you've got a single server dev environment, that'll improve it. A lot of people say turn off search, but often you're trying to develop search web parts, so search needs to be running. So try cranking that down. On big farms, I might run it at 2, so but on smaller farms, I'd run that for 1 thread. Now, another one that, this was a great selling feature of SharePoint, you could do continuous crawling. Anyone here doing continuous crawling? Yeah, plenty of people doing continuous crawling. It's a great feature. If you're creating so much content every 5 minutes that you can't do an incremental crawl of that content within 5 minutes, this was a great feature. So if you had, say, 100,000 users all creating Word documents, you were likely to be creating hundreds of Word documents, you know, every 5 minutes. And that's what continuous crawl is for, that when we start doing an incremental crawl, we take a snapshot of what we ask SharePoint, what's changed? SharePoint keeps a change log in the SQL database. We don't have to actually go and crawl the content. We say to SQL, give me the change log. What's changed since I last did a crawl? It comes back with a bunch of URLs to documents and web pages. I then start crawling it. In the meantime, people are updating more content. So if my crawl, my incremental crawl, didn't finish within 5 minutes, say, then I would have some stale content. And stale content is not good when you're using the search web parts to drive the content on your page if you want that content to be near real time. It's never going to be real time. So by default, continuous crawl defaults to every 15 minutes. Microsoft recommend you change that to 5 minutes if you're so worried about the freshness of content coming back in search. But what I say to most customers is, hey, if we weren't using continuous crawl and just using the normal incremental crawl, how long does it take to do an incremental crawl? So every customer I've looked at during the business hours, it's between about 5 and 7 minutes to do an incremental crawl. Now, the thing about continuous crawl, while it was great if you had so much content changing every 15 minutes that incremental crawl couldn't keep up with it, but it creates a very complicated bucket system for storing the catalog in. And at the very bottom level, the L1 level, that's all cached in memory. So you can imagine we're going to get a lot of L1s because there's L1s for every L2. And then there's L2s for every L3. And what happens is with the incremental crawl, SharePoint just creates another layer at that layer. So L1, we create another one until we get too much data in there, too much of a change. And then it has to merge that up a level, merges it up to level 2. When my three level 2s under that level 3 get a certain amount of change in them, or I've got to add more content, we do a merge into that level 3 to merge them all back up. Now, that's unpredictable when that's going to happen. And once you get up to, say, a level 3 or a level 4, merging up a level, that's almost like doing a full index as far as the impact on the query partition itself. And if you're replicating that partition, all of that's going to go across the other server as well. So my real kind of point is, do you really need to do incremental continuous crawl? Because there's a bigger overhead on your content processing and index partition, or especially, sorry, the index partition, than just doing an incremental crawl. Incremental crawl is really simple. There are two catalogs, version 0 and version 1, and the querying is using one, and the incremental crawl is updating the other, and when it finishes, it tells the front-end query processor, I've finished updating this copy of the catalog, you switch over and use this one. My next incremental crawl, I'm going to update the other one. It's really simple. It's like a flip-flop system. It works. Both of them, though, do have a dependency on the hard drive. If one of your servers runs out of disk space and you've got a distributed catalog, the other one goes, hey, I'm out of sync with the other one, let's all shut down. And that's when any user search stops working. So you really do have to monitor that volume that you allocate for storing the catalog on. So topology, for the average size customer, it should kind of look like this, where you've got two web front ends and two application servers that you'll be having your crawler. Most people don't need to distribute their crawling. You don't usually have enough content to warrant that. So you've got crawling and content processing on one, but you're copying the index partition across both of your application servers, and then your web front-end servers are just running the query role. And the query role, as I said, is all about the end user executing searches and getting results back. So that's a good, healthy-looking search topology for a two web front-end, two application server farm. I've seen plenty that don't look like that. So that's just a warning. Go back and look at your SharePoint farm if you've got this model and see if that's what yours looks like. That's probably, I think, the best one to have. So some of the non-functional requirements, and I'm not going to go into this into too much detail, but really trying to look at kind of what kind of size are you. And I've worked in all of these different size ranges and design farms, and there's always trade-offs, which we're going to talk a little bit about. How much availability do you need? Do you need load balancing? Now, if you're going to use Windows network load balancing, because you say, yes, we want high availability, it's only going to mean that half of your users will still keep accessing SharePoint when the farm goes, fails, or one of the web front ends fails. So it doesn't actually fail over the existing users. It's only if you turn off a network adapter, then it will switch everyone over to the other. But if your SharePoint farm stops responding, it's not based on the health of the web front ends. So unless you do have something like an F5 load balancer that you're going to configure properly, why not just rely on VMware crash recovery? If our virtual machine crashes, VMware will start it back up again. If the host crashes, you can use other technology within the virtualization stack to start that virtual machine back up on another host, and maybe it'll be down for 5 minutes. You're still going to meet your probably 2.9s availability, hopefully, that you want for SharePoint during business hours. So really, what are those requirements around fault tolerance? When did you last see Windows crash? I mean, SQL Server's always been pretty bulletproof. Even if it goes down unexpectedly, it recovers really well. Especially if you've got enterprise version, it recovers really fast. SQL Standard takes a little bit longer to get through all the databases, check the consistency of them, but it still comes back really, really well. So unless you, a lot of people think we need an enterprise solution, we've got to have these two web front ends, load balancing, don't do it on the cheap, it's probably better not to do it at all and rely on VMware crash recovery. The other one is DR. So a lot of people go, yeah, don't worry about DR, we've got SAN replication or we're using SRM or, you know, we've got some other wacky system that works for all of our other servers, it'll work for SharePoint. It probably won't be supported by Microsoft. Okay, so things like snapshots don't work, using Veeam, you know, trying to, if one of your SharePoint servers dies, okay, and you've got a backup from last night, if you restore that backup and it, say, happens to be one of your application servers that was had an index replica on it, and you restore it, it's completely out of sync with the other one, so both of them will stop. They'll just go, something wrong here, shut down search. So it is not a recovery solution for a single server. It does not work. Really, the key thing about DR that you need to worry about is you cannot reconstitute the user's data. You can reconstitute a SharePoint farm lots of ways, hopefully scripted install, you know, restoring service configurations, really, really nice. It's the data you want to get protected. Log shipping is still a supported way, unless you've got like a millisecond latency between your production and DR environment, then log shipping is the solution. So get that kind of going first. It can cover a multitude of sins having your data replicated somewhere else in a reliable way. Now, a lot of people will talk about, always on high availability groups. Well, that's great, but it's a real-time copy of the data. And what say we apply a SharePoint patch and something goes wrong with that patch, and that was updating the schema of the databases. That's all just been replicated, right? So I can't fail over to the other one because it's got the wrong now copy of the data on it as well. So log shipping is good because you can send the logs up there but not replay them till the next day. So you send your logs to your DR location, but it's still got the databases from yesterday on it, so if we really hose our SharePoint farm, we can get yesterday's SharePoint farm up and running. Like, I can do that in a couple of hours. That's a really nice thing to be able to fall back on. Unlikely to ever use this concept of a split farm, which is something we talked about in 2010 a lot, where if you had, you know, fiber a couple of kilometres and you had a data centre on each side of the highway, you could actually put, you know, one node of each your SQL cluster in each location, split your SharePoint servers in your farm across both locations as well. Not very likely to be a solution for either high availability or DR. A couple of customers might be able to do it, but whenever I have people say, yes, we've got, you know, a fiber connection to Auckland, or, you know, however fast it is, 20 megabyte pipe, I say, is it 1 millisecond latency? If the answer is yes, you can do it. If the answer is no, you can't. But the key thing in working out how big our topology is what's the workload going to be on it, and there are completely different workloads that could be done on SharePoint. So it's really looking at this graph here and saying, so how much co-authoring do I want in SharePoint? It's a fantastic feature, but not that many people use it. But it does have quite an overhead on the server. It's very chatty what's going on behind the scenes as soon as you've got, you know, 3, 4, or 5 people co-authoring on the document. It's a fantastic feature, though. I use it for tenders all the time. Then you've got how many people are using the Office client, and this is really the biggest overhead on SharePoint. If you're doing an EDRMS solution for 2,000 users, we're taking the network share away from them and making them use SharePoint, this is going to generate the biggest load on SharePoint in a lot of different ways. Web dev, the old clients, people either mapping network drives, a bad thing to do on SharePoint, but now and again you've got people who want to do it. It's bad for a whole bunch of reasons. The worst one is if you've got required metadata required checkout on. The user's happily saving their documents and saying to other people, yeah, I've saved all my documents up there and no one else can see them because they all remain checked out. There's not a version that's ever been published. That user can see the documents, no one else can. Also, web dev is a really old technology, so if you're saving to a drive letter which happens to be mapped to a SharePoint site, every time you hit save, it's sending the entire document over the wire back to SharePoint. If you use Office 2010 or 2013 natively and hit save every 5 minutes, like most users do, it only sends the difference. What have I done in the last 5 minutes is the only thing that gets sent over the wire. So it's really, really fast. That's why Office 365 works so well. If you're only using Office documents, they use a different protocol than WebDAV. Client-side object model. This will probably get more, but all those web parts on a page, the page just downloads the JavaScript, like the jQuery code, and that code then has to make a connection back to SharePoint. So it's like lots of extra connections back to SharePoint, generates a load. There are lots of things that call the web services still in SharePoint. So if you go to a SharePoint calendar and then you say link to Outlook, Outlook remembers that URL, but it's a web service call. And Outlook goes, yeah, every 15 minutes I'm going to make that web service call and see if anything's changed in that library or list. So that generates a load on the server. Some of the Office integration is really, really great. With SharePoint, it just generates some load. And then obviously your page visits. And pages are getting heavier. Client-side object model is great, but it generates a lot more work for the server because now instead of sending all the payload down, which I used to do in the data view web part, that was the code and the rendering information in one hit, now we're sending down some code, and that code then has to make a call back to the server to get more data back down to then render it using the client's processing capability instead of SharePoint's processing capability. I don't actually know if all those numbers add up to 100%. hopefully they do. 35, yeah, probably does. Pretty close. So what is your mix of those workloads is really going to determine what capacity you need. Now, most people used to talk about requests per second, and that's very much web-focused, but a document management request is a huge amount of work. If I want to download a 20-megabyte PowerPoint, I could say that's one request. But that's a lot more work on the server. If I'm editing that document, it's going to involve, you know, caching that, getting the file out of SQL Server, getting it on my web front end, chunking that up into 5-meg chunks if I'm using WebDAV, converting it to the MSHTTP something or other protocol if I'm using the new version of Office, tracking, you know, what I've sent down to the user, so every time they hit save, I can merge the differences back. That's a different protocol to then the shredded storage, which is how SharePoint then writes that document back to the database. So you're going to get quite a variation here of the requests per second you will get out of your web front-end service. And a lot of people just look at the ASP.NET counters, but that's only about half the story. So it will vary a lot. So your traditional web front-end server, if you've, say, got an intranet with light document management, you'll probably easily get 40 requests per second out of a 4-core machine with, you know, a good 16 gigs of RAM, which is probably equivalent to 400 actual users. So, you know, if you've got 1,000 users, you'll usually get away with 2 web front-end servers. But if you're doing heavy document management, you'll get a lot less requests per second. So you'll need more capacity if all your users are doing document management inside SharePoint. But most organizations have quite a mixture. A lot of people are only accessing the intranet, you know, team sites maybe, and then a smaller group, usually corporate services or something, doing all of their document management inside SharePoint. The other thing to remember that because 2013 has a bigger overhead on it, you'll get slightly less throughput than you got on 2010. So sometimes you might have got away with a single web front-end server on 2010. You'll still be able to do that on 2013, but all of a sudden the pages might be a little bit slower. You know, it might take 2 seconds for a page to render instead of 1.5 seconds. So that's the thing to be aware of there. So then we come on to, well, talked about kind of web pages and document management, kind of 2 of the most common things out of the box. But what else are we going to do on our 2013 environment? So one of them is workflow. We all want to do workflow. And SharePoint 2013 introduced 2013 workflow. The thing is, it doesn't actually come with SharePoint. SharePoint comes with 2010 workflow out of the box. If you go to a publishing library and you turn on the workflow option, it says these pages must be approved. I want approval workflow. And use the nice forms that are generated automatically in SharePoint 2013, that's only using SharePoint 2010. Okay, it's not using anything to do with 2013. 2013 workflow is an Azure thing that was primarily designed for 365 because the scalability, if you had 100,000 employees and had workflows going on all over the place, that was one of the big limitations in 2010. So 2013 has a whole separate workflow engine which should really run on different servers. Now, in a small environment, you might be able to get away with putting the 2013 workflow on your SharePoint servers, but it really should be on dedicated servers because it's not patched by SharePoint. When you do updates, SharePoint updates don't include anything about 2013 workflow on them. It's a whole different thing that you have to manage. And it requires subscription management services in SharePoint, which often you wouldn't turn on by default. The other one is apps. So apps are really cool. They're great. Go to the App Store, download some widgets and gadgets, and use your credit card to pay for them if they're not free. That's probably going to work well for corporates. But if you want to use them on-premise, You know, it requires a dedicated domain. The recommendation is a dedicated domain. You could do it on the same domain that your SharePoint's running on, but you're open to cross-site scripting issues. So you need a whole different DNS registered with an SSL wildcard that's going to work for that. So that's some overhead. You need a web application in SharePoint that doesn't have a host header associated with it for that to work. That's where I think that hybrid model is great. I can have apps in 365 because it's all configured for me. I don't have to worry about any of the complexities around the infrastructure to get that going. The other big one is BI. So the user experience for Microsoft BI is now SharePoint, pretty much. You know, yes, you've got SQL and analytics in the back end, but SharePoint is the user experience. Reporting services especially is fantastic in SharePoint. You know, you just use a SharePoint library. You can version your RDL and RDS files. You can use SharePoint permissions to control who accesses the reports, not the old report dashboard, which was a terrible thing if you ever had to use it. So really great features, but because SharePoint now runs in claims mode, a lot of the BI capability from Microsoft Analysis Services only works with, you know, Windows Integrated Security. It doesn't work with SQL authentication. And because SharePoint now runs in claims means you have to run the claims to Windows Token Service. You need to think about, definitely got to run Kerberos just about all the time. So there's a bit more complexity there. And some of the BI features have been enhanced. The user end of the BI features has been enhanced in 365, hasn't yet made it to on-premise. And we don't know if it will make it to on-premise. So if you've seen the PowerView demos on 365, they're really, really nice. They're all HTML5. They work on mobile devices, on-prem, Silverlight. You know, still looks nice, but you've got to have IE. So that's something to be aware of if you want to deploy that. Microsoft have made a bit of a change recently, and we used to say all of this stuff goes on the application layer, but things like Excel services, reporting services, Microsoft now says, well, that's really a front-end role. Users are interacting with those things. You could put those on the front-end. That means now we have to scale up the front-end if we want to do that. The last one is access services. If you've got the enterprise CAL, access services are pretty cool, actually, now, unlike 2010. When you create an Access app, it gets its own SQL database now. It's a fully functional SQL-driven application. It's really like a 4GL or a rapid way of building the front end, which is fully HTML compliant now. It's a really good feature, but it requires all of that apps infrastructure to get it going. So again, that's a complex thing to deploy. This is a dead ringer for using hybrid. You've already got that infrastructure in the cloud with your E3 license. Go ahead and build your Access apps in the cloud. They're lightweight anyway because they're browser-based. It's an ideal thing to do in 365. Work management service. This is a cool feature in SharePoint that lets you kind of cross-pollinate your tasks between Outlook and tasks you might be doing in Project Server, or you might just create project template sites in 365 or in SharePoint on-premise. Really nice feature, but to use it on-premise, you have to have Exchange 2013 on-premise as well. This does not work in a hybrid model. Now, unfortunately, the Exchange 2013 is the thing everyone should have moved to the cloud already. There's kind of no excuse for hosting your own SharePoint server anymore. Your own Exchange server anymore. But as soon as you do that, and Exchange is often the first workload to go into 365, then you don't get this functionality anymore, which is a bit of a shame. It might happen in the future. I probably wouldn't bet on it. I don't know how much more in the hybrid model, how much work will be done. There might be a little bit more done. We don't know yet. So, as I said, what impact do these particular things have on your topology? You've got to remember that you turn on all those enterprise features, create those service applications. They're all generate web service endpoints. They've all got their own code and .NET assemblies they have to run. It's actually amazing when you think about it. When you go to a SharePoint page and go refresh, the page actually comes back. You ever turn on the developer dashboard and see how much is going on behind the scenes to render that page? So if you skimp on the infrastructure that you give that page, it's going to take a long time. I see SharePoint farms that take 5 seconds to render a pretty generic page. It's not as bad in 2013 with a minimal download strategy, which is another great thing Microsoft did. There's a lot of times where you won't use that. You want a nice branded intranet, you know, customized. Minimal download strategy really only works when you've got a team site out of the box, standard web parts on the page. When you go from page to page, it only sends down, using AJAX, the web parts that are different in that in the web part zones, if you like. So topology, lots of options. You start with a single server. Now, as I mentioned, Microsoft support, it needs 6 cores. So go ask your VMware guy for a 6-core virtual machine. probably going to have a bit of an argument on your hands. You've still got to do a bit of tweaking to get things done, because if you do a full index, you know, that server's going to be busy, not really interested in responding to end user queries because it's flat out indexing content. Kind of more traditional, just two servers. Yes, we've got high availability, but those two servers are still, you know, conflicting. I'm trying to respond to end user requests and I'm trying to do back end processing as well. Don't do this very often. Well, I haven't seen this actually, this deployment. Then you get into the more common one. We've got our web front end servers. We've got all of our application batch processing in the middle tier and our database, you know, cluster. Clusters are great because you can apply service packs to them without taking the cluster down, but you've only got one copy of the content. All right, so if the content gets corrupted, we're hosed. Along came high availability groups. That's great. Replicate the content. Forgot SQL standard. One of them's in read-only, so I really can't fail over to it. Enterprise is pretty good. It's a lot more infrastructure, obviously, for IT to manage. Myself, I like single SQL server box and log shipping. It's really simple, and SQL is bulletproof. I love SQL. And then you can really scale out and go, yes, we want to deploy workflow manager and maybe some other components, some applications of our own with web services in them that are using client-side object model to talk to SharePoint, or the server object model, which, of course, Wayne will say, don't write any more server object model code, but it's still a little gap, so sometimes we have to do that. But kind of a pretty typical topology, as I said. I'm starting to see now NoSQL cluster. VMware crash recovery is pretty good. SQL's very good. Index availability, which you get through this. So having our two web front-end servers up the top there. So two web front-end servers running the query and running the distributed cache on them. We're going to have our Office web app server, so we'll have that highly available as well. That does not need a SharePoint license. That's a Windows license only, free download from Microsoft to get Office web apps running, so it previews in the search results. And then we've got really our main application server, running our, you know, our crawling and our content processing. It's got the index partition on it, and that's been replicated over to the other application server. And this other application server is usually the one that I'll make what I'll call my BI server. I'm going to put reporting services on there because it's going to take a SQL license as well as a SharePoint license to run that. I might run Excel services on it as well, because it's only really keeping a replica of the index partition that the query servers are talking to, and it's not doing that content processing. So there's plenty of spare processing capacity on that second application server to do all my BI tasks. So it's just some interesting things around there. We find a full crawl if you've got a terabyte of content. It takes about 12 hours if you set that content processing, sorry, the number of threads to one. If you leave it on three, it'll take about 7 or 8 hours, but that CPU is running at 100% the whole time, and some people don't like seeing that, as I mentioned. And backing up, if you've got SQL standard, takes about 3 hours on a terabyte of content. If you've got, you know, 100 gig content databases, it actually takes a while to back them up. They go offline while they're being backed up. There's also a whole bunch of timer jobs that update the statistics on the databases, rebuild the indexes. Things like that are going to happen every single night as well, so you've got to take that into account. Good thing about that model is you can start off smaller, right? So you can go, yeah, we don't actually need high availability. Initially, we're going to have 200, 300, 400 users. We can get away with this model here. Rely on VMware HA to kind of keep it up and running within about 5 minutes of it going down. And that's a very cost-effective model. Obviously, we've got two SharePoint servers we license, a SQL server we license. Our Logship SQL box doesn't have to be licensed because it's kind of like a warm standby. We ship the logs to it. We can replay the logs, but the database must be in recovery mode. And then I could stand up a SharePoint farm in that DR site if I want and connect to that data and flip over to that farm. Maybe in read-only mode. My SharePoint, my host crashes. VMware, you know, belly up, as it now and again does, usually due to the sand falling over or something like that. I don't want to have a DR system that's all of a sudden rewrite mode, because as soon as users start updating the SharePoint on the DR site, how am I going to flip back? That's going to take twice as big an outage because I have to shut down both ends, copy the data back, stand up this end, re-get log shipping going back to that end again before we can stand up. The nice thing about that model is with log shipping, I can have a read-only version of SharePoint running in the other farm. That gives me a bit of breathing room to get my production environment back up and running and then flip back to production. So normally in people's kind of time to recovery, it gets a bit more complex. I'd say They have a four-hour outage. After 4 hours, we will bring up a read-only copy of SharePoint for another 4 hours while we do everything we can to get production working again. If we can't after that additional 4 hours, then yes, okay, we'll make the DR site read write. So that's a much better process than just having this rule that says, no, we're going to have to flip over to DR, because then you've got to think about how do we get back. Unless you run the model of an A and a B farm, which I do have with some customers, we say there's no production and pre-production. There's an A and a B farm. Anyone could be production at any given point in time, because when we fail over, we don't want an outage to fail back. So that's another valid way of considering how to do it. As I mentioned, SQL Server Standard versus Enterprise for people interested in this. The biggest kind of limitations with SQL Standard are around the single thread nature of a whole bunch of functions inside SQL Server, which have a big impact on SharePoint. Not so much an impact on normal transaction systems. You've got to remember, when you save a 20 megabyte PowerPoint, that's a transaction in SQL. 20 megabyte file going in the transaction log. Normal applications like CRM or Dynamics, the transactions are really, really small. So some of those key ones there are creating indexes. SharePoint uses TempDB a lot. There's always going to be indexes on that. There's only one thread to be able to do that at a time. DBCC, which you should be doing before you do every backup. Can only do one database at a time, one thread at a time to do that. Replaying logs in our DR environment, it's only got one thread to replay the logs. So we've got a whole lot of databases all with your own transaction logs. It's going to be a little bit behind replaying those logs. The always-on availability groups you get now with 2012, really nice. You can have a two-node cluster, but the second node is read-only. So you can't actually fail over to it without doing a whole bunch of extra work. And then how do you get it back in the proper cluster mode? Another big one is offline index rebuilds only. So every night, SharePoint says, rebuild the indexes on all my content databases. So they go offline while it's doing it. SQL Server Enterprise can do rebuild indexes online so long as they're not 30% out of date. So what that can mean is you're trying to do your backup at the same time SQL Server's trying to rebuild the indexes on the database. And you find that your backups are paused until the database is ready. Or the backup doesn't happen at all. So there's a tick box in your maintenance plan for SQL that says if the database is offline, skip it. Okay, that has some pretty severe consequences if you're not backing up your content database each night. Got all your transaction logs, but it takes a while to replay those, as I said. So you don't get database compression or encryption. SharePoint doesn't actually support doing the compression on all the databases, but the logging database, you can do it on because it can get very big. Another tip, when you turn on the logging, it stores, I think, 14 days worth. And have you ever seen a SharePoint farm where the logging database is already 40 or 50 gigs? That's because there's a huge amount of default data that gets stored in there. Microsoft recommends on TechNet that you actually either turn that off or set it to a much smaller time. I set all of ours to 3 days, and then only increase it when you've actually got a problem you're trying to troubleshoot. The SQL Standard, you don't get PowerView or PowerPivot because they're actually a license that comes with SQL Enterprise that entitles you to use those features. And Performance Point is quite limited if using SQL Standard because of some of the analysis services limitations. Big, big difference is the price, obviously, and that's one of the drivers why a lot of customers do use SQL Standard. Another big area around the topology, it's not really part of SharePoint, but it's thinking about how do I grant extranet access to my SharePoint environment, or I'm going to do my internet and my intranet site. Do I need two SharePoint farms? The answer to that is no. The confusion was that Microsoft said, a lot of people use ISA or TMG or UAG, and then Microsoft said, well, they're kind of deprecated now. Still supported, but no future lifespan. So how can we host SharePoint? And Microsoft to come out with a new product called the Web Application Proxy. And this is a really, really great tool for a whole bunch of reasons for exposing one SharePoint farm for multiple roles. We can use it for our partner extranet, for remote access to our intranet, hosting our public website, all off one SharePoint farm. And so the features of this web application proxy that make it really good, it is a reverse proxy. So from a security point of view, some people would say, no, put your web front ends in the DMZ or put a whole other SharePoint farm in the DMZ and do read-only domain controllers or set up one-way trust. You end up opening up so many firewall ports to get that to go. It's as wide as a barn door being open. A proxy does not allow any TCP connection from the internet right through to your SharePoint server. So there's no user connection from the internet through to your SharePoint farm. It's reverse proxying. We're used to proxying to access the internet from work to get out to the internet. This works the other way around. A whole bunch of features. One of the good ones is does SSL offloading. So I can load my SSL certificates on my proxy, the request comes in over HTTPS, and then we just go HTTP through a VLAN through to our SharePoint server. We don't need the SharePoint servers doing the overhead of the SSL encryption and decryption, which is quite an overhead now if you're using larger keys. I won't go through all of those features, but the other aspect, apart from just reverse proxying, is the authentication. So today, if you just use a normal reverse proxy, maybe you've got a firewall that can proxy things, so we can get through to SharePoint, but SharePoint has to do the authentication. So the users are getting all the way through to SharePoint, and SharePoint is popping up the Windows login box for the user to log in. The web application proxy can do pre-authentication. It can tie in with your ADFS server. Automatically, it has the ADFS proxy built in, so now we can have a lovely forms logon page for our user to log on. We can now also configure that they can log on with their email address, even if the email address doesn't match the UPN in SharePoint. So UPN might be org.local or org.internal because you've got a domain that you set up originally using that namespace. Now let them log in using their email address. The WAP gateway is going to log them in, make sure they've got a valid AD account. It's going to create the claim that's going to go through to SharePoint, and then they'll be logged in automatically on SharePoint. The nice thing there is it's single sign-on. They can be logged on to Outlook Anywhere. They can be logged on to other applications you've got. All you can do if you join the WAP, this is a bit of a conflict thing scenario, if you join your WAP gateway to the domain, which is a pain because you have to open up more holes, then you can do Windows Integrated Security, but still have a forms logon page, a bit like what we used to be able to do with ISA. Have a form logon page, but then do Windows Integrated Security, enable Kerberos on it. If you don't want to join your WAP server to the domain, which I prefer not to do, standalone WAP server in the DMZ, which would look like this, a WAP server sitting here, not domain joined, but what it does is let me identify the difference between things I want to publish where I want to trust the device and things I'm happy to publish where I don't need to trust the device. So I can have rules in my, when I publish something that says, do I need two-factor authentication for the intranet, but not two-factor authentication for the partner extranet, which is a very good scenario to use. We might have sensitive company information on the intranet. I want staff to be able to access it from their iPad, but I want to know what iPad they're using. I don't want it the iPad that their kids use to play Angry Birds, and I now want to play Turn Off the Power Station. So I want a trusted device that I've given the user, but it can't be domain joined. iPad can't be domain joined, but it can now be workgroup joined. And I can specify through these policies which SharePoint web application is going to have what rules on it. So it could be any device that connects to it, still with an AD account, or not. So that's really the future. And the good thing about this infrastructure is it also is the core infrastructure needed for the hybrid model. So it's the same model that says I've got users inside, they're using SharePoint, but all of a sudden they go to their my site. That's out in 365. This is going to do the single sign-on for me as well, that they won't notice that. It'll just be, they'll click on our SharePoint site, their OneDrive link at the top, and they'll be going off to 365 and never be prompted for a login. So this really is the thing to think about investing in, using WAP and ADFS for incoming and outgoing hybrid model of SharePoint. So on-premise, there's still a few risks. There's a bunch of kind of, I call them incompatibilities, but SharePoint's a complex product, has dependency on a whole bunch of other components now. And we've seen this starting to happen. Security update through Windows Update Services happens to include a couple of SharePoint components in it. The key thing with SharePoint, whenever you deploy any update on SharePoint, you've got to run psconfig. If your server was set up to automatically run WSUS or Windows Updates, all of a sudden you've deployed an update to SharePoint, but you haven't run psconfig. Microsoft recommend that psconfig should be run within 3 days, I think is the last thing I saw on TechNet, before you could get into a risky scenario with getting your farm out of support. A lot of people don't realize this patch that came out about 2 months ago, MS14-022, updated your SharePoint environments. You've got new binaries, but your database hasn't been updated. So if you actually go into central admin and look at the upgrade status, you'll probably find that your farm has a required update still requiring you to run psconfig. Obviously, big dependency on .NET. So we've seen certain .NET updates that do things like break some web parts. That's happened in the past. You need to manage the distributed cache independently, so it has its own updates, and they're always fixing and improving the performance. If you installed SharePoint out of the box and let it do the web install of downloading those components, the distributed cache is well out of date. It should be running, I think it was a cumulative update 3 for the distributed cache 1.1. Workflow services needs to be updated independently from SharePoint. Office web apps, when you update those, you have to disconnect them from SharePoint and then delete the web app farm, apply the updates, recreate a farm, reconnect it to SharePoint. So hopefully you documented how you did all of that. Also for the BI features, there are a whole lot of weird dependencies. There's still some SQL 2008 bits that need to be on the SharePoint server. Then you've got your reporting services, and you should be, you know, installing the 2012 SP1 slipstream version, not deploying the RTM version and then adding SP1 on top, because that's actually missing a bunch of features, some really cool features for BI, where you don't actually have to even install analysis services on the SharePoint server now. You install analysis services on your BI SQL box and just put the add-in on SharePoint, and it will talk to analysis services without having to be on the same server. But you can only do that if you use the slipstreamed SP1 install, not if you upgraded your SQL 2012 to SP1. So it can go on forever. There's a whole lot of operational things. So do you still want to host SharePoint on-premise? I hope they haven't scared everybody off, because there's still some lots of benefits of on-premise, but these are some of the reasons why the cloud is the way to go. Are there any questions? No? No questions. I'm going to hang around for half an hour outside, because I'm sure some people want to come up and hassle me either about what I said, or Wayne might even stick around and we can debate a few of the points. But thank you very much for your time, and enjoy lunch.